This is Deanna Spingola. It is Saturday, June 23rd, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Jarrah White. The website is moonmovie.com. Welcome, Jarrah. So nice to talk to you again.
It's nice to be back.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for taking time. It's morning where you're at, and it's evening where I am at.
That's what happens. We have two sides of the world.
Yeah.
We get different time zones.
That's so true. So you were on my other RBN program. It's been a while, and your contentions, and I certainly believe you, is that Frank Borman and Buzz Aldrin and some of those other people who claim to have been to the moon didn't really actually go to the moon. And when,
yeah, that's correct. They didn't go to the moon.
So what did they do?
Some of the missions stayed in low Earth orbit. Others never even left the ground. The missions that stayed in low Earth orbit, for example, were like Apollo's 10 and 11. The Apollo 10 videos, for example, they were broadcasting videos back to Earth, you know, supposedly. And these videos, they were clearly edited because there was camera cuts all over the place, despite the audio being uninterrupted. Now, they only had one camera in the spacecraft. That cannot happen if, you know, they only have the one camera. It's a live broadcast. That doesn't happen, you know. It's supposed to be streamed live. There's no camera cuts, and there's camera cuts in this thing. And that was on Apollo 10. So that mission stayed in low Earth orbit, and those the views of Earth they filmed were obviously pre-filmed and then edited together. You know, sandwiched between the films they had of them, you know, floating around in the capsule. But as for some of the later missions, I believe Apollo 15, I believe that one stayed on the ground. I had a look at the in-flight television transmissions from that one, and believe it or not, there is no footage of there's no confirmed definite zero gravity in there. No definite evidence that they're actually in space, because the broadcasts consist of a couple of astronauts standing around in the LEM, you know, for about an hour or so, doing nothing, and the only hints of zero gravity, they all seem to last 30 seconds or less. And so if you were on the Earth, you know, on board a plane, and that plane formed a parabolic arc, that would temporarily eliminate gravity inside the aeroplane and allow you to float around for about 30 seconds. That's actually what they did to train astronauts, you know, for their space missions. And in fact, that's how they filmed the zero gravity scenes in the movie Apollo 13 with Tom Hanks. I believe that the Apollo 15 mission was done the same way. And that when it was time for those astronauts to return, they simply boarded a capsule that was then dropped out above the ocean from a C-5A transport plane. And in fact, a commercial airline pilot actually called up Bill Kasing, who was the author of We Never Went to the Moon. While he was doing a radio show, a pilot actually called up and said he saw the capsule dumped out the back of a plane when it was time for them to return.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
Okay, Bill Kasing, he wrote We Never Went to the Moon, America's $30 billion swindle.
That's correct.
And that was released in 1974. And now, who did he work for? Did he work for Rocketdyne?
That's correct. He worked for Rocketdyne. He was their head of technical publications. He worked as a service engineer and a service analyst, and basically he would check over the rockets, the supplies and stuff. He would like evaluate, okay, this is good for testing, this is good for launch, and write technical reports on that. And during his time there, he became aware of this clandestine organization called the Apollo Simulation Project, which was a group assembled together to talk about, okay, how can we simulate flights to the moon and then purport them to be the real thing. He was aware of all these plans that they were coming up with, right? But he left the program before he left it in 1963, you know, obviously before those plans went into action. But he, you know, he kept what he knew to himself. And he didn't even watch the Apollo 11 moon landings because of it. You know, he didn't feel enthusiastic about watching something that he knew was going to be fake. And so he kept that to himself. And then finally, you know, he used to bring homeless people back to his houseboat. He had to offer them shelter, and offer them food and a bed to sleep and everything. And one night he was having a conversation with with one of the people he brought into his home. He went by the name of John Grant. He was a former Vietnam veteran, and he was really angered. He says, like, "Bill, I was convinced that what I did was patriotic, but that's a load of bull. Why don't you blow the whistle on this rotten, corrupt government?" And Grant, he was actually suggesting Bill Gasing do a satire. He says, "Why don't you say something outrageous like we never went to the moon?" But of course, Bill Gasing obviously decided to do a serious project because he, he had all this inside knowledge at Rocketdyne, and he also around. I'm not sure if it was. If it was before or after, I can't remember right now, but sometime as well, Bill Gasing actually also learned about a fellow called Thomas Ronald Barron, who was a safety inspector for North American Aviation, which was the company that built the Apollo spacecraft. And he wrote a report detailing all these different safety violations and mismanagement that had happened leading up to the Apollo 1 fire. He wrote a 500-page report. Initially, he wrote a 50-page report, and he got fired from his job after that report went public. But he continued with his research. He spoke to various people who were still working on the program. He looked back to all his records, and eventually it became a 500-page report. And after the fire, he testified, saying that the Apollo program was in such disarray that they were not going to get to the moon. And he also said that according to one of the witnesses he spoke to, the astronauts initially reported fire much earlier than when NASA claimed. They said that from the first mention of fire to the moment the capsule ruptured, only 30 seconds went by. And yet according to this fellow he spoke to, his name was Al Holmberg, he said that there was at least 10 minutes before the 10 or 12 minutes before the capsule rupture. They first reported smelling smoke or fire 10 minutes prior, and then for 5 minutes they tried to get out. Now,
oh
Holmberg
my
later,
goodness, that yes. is a big discrepancy.
Yeah, Holmberg later denied what he told Barron, but another fellow by the name of Gary Probst reported something similar. He said that there was that minutes had gone by from the first mention of fire till the moment the capsule filled with flames. He was watching the fire on the monitors. Now, after Barron testified, he was found dead at a railroad crossing. His car had been struck by a train.
Oh my goodness!
Yeah, no, that's what got and his conversation with Grant really encouraged Bill Gasing to come out and speak publicly about the Apollo simulation project, about how the Apollo program was a hoax, and so yeah, that's how that all pretty much got started. He wrote a book called We Never Went to the Moon, which basically documented everything he knew from his time at Rocketdyne, and also he discussed how they could have gone about faking this, and discussed various photographic anomalies that he had noticed, like particularly that there is no blast crater under the lunar module. Prior to the landing, everyone was suspecting that there would be a blast crater under them. There was a fellow by the name of Thomas Gold. He was actually concerned about the dust, kicking up, spraying all over the windows and everything else. And
sure.
Von Braun, and Von Braun in the beginning, he had proposed back in the 1950s, he had proposed his own moonship, and the engine exhaust that of his ship, was similar in pressure to the actual Apollo lander. He had predicted that there would be a crater dug underneath his moonship, and lo and behold, we see the photographs. There's no blast crater. There's no dust blown away. That you can even see pebbles directly underneath the engine bell. You take a leaf blower, you introduce it to some dust, and the dust blows away. It doesn't stay around. There's nothing there. There's bedrock. And yet here we've got, loose grains of dust, we've got pebbles and tiny rocks and everything else underneath the lander. There's no blast crater, there's no dust blown away. The limb's completely clean too. There's nothing. He was actually, Thomas Gold was actually concerned about the dust even, coating up the windows, because it would be kicking up all over the place.
Sure. Now, didn't Von Braun say that it would take a ship the size of the Queen Mary to actually go there with all the stuff that it would have to take and with all the power?
Yeah, he wrote that in his book, Conquest of the Moon. He actually proposed building a spaceship first, prior to actually getting, prior to actually going to the moon. He proposed building the spaceship, sorry, building the space station, with the where the rocket that was supposed to go to the moon would just stay there, and they transferred to the space station, transferred to the rocket ship, where they would assemble this thing in orbit, and then they'd make the burn to the moon. The whole ship would be too large anyways, because of the radiation requirements.
Van Allen belts.
The Van Allen belts in the 1950s. Van Allen, he had been sending Geiger counters up into space. He had put them in his Raccoons, which was basically a weather balloon which would carry a rocket, and once it would reach peak altitude, the rocket would fire, and it would carry into space these Geiger counters. And after that, he would start sending satellites and moon-bound spacecraft. They'd also carry Geiger counters, and once they'd get to a certain altitude, once they get to about 1,000 kilometers up, the Geiger counters would become incredibly busy. They'd be constantly sending back all these counts. They would go like click click click, and then click 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 click, and then suddenly they just die. Previously their counts were coming in sort of steadily, it's higher than we expected, but okay, that's not too bad. Then suddenly, boom, the counts would go through the roof, and then finally the machines would just die on him because there was too much radiation for them to cope with. And so he released a number of reports saying that the engineering, the shielding is quite beyond engineering feasibility in the near future, and that all manned spaceflight attempts should steer clear of these two belts of radiation. He was constantly lobbying against moon-bound travel because of that reason. And in fact, on Apollo 8, when it was one of the astronauts, Frank Borman, he was vomiting on that flight, supposedly on his way to the moon. Yeah, supposedly from motion sickness or whatever. But Van Allen's initial reaction was, "Oh my God, he must be suffering from radiation sickness. Turn around, abort the mission, abort it." But you know, he never. But he had Borman. He's still alive today. They never suffered from any radiation symptoms or anything like that. They're all alive and kicking. Well, most of them are anyway. Some of them have died from old age or whatever. And so the whole fact of the matter is they had no shielding, right? If you can't go someplace because you're going to die as a result of it, then you can't come back here and say that you went there.
Right. Now, which people at NASA would know about the fake project? I mean, would it be just a small group of people, or, people who probably participated, but they were kind of compartmentalized and they really didn't know what they were involved in?
It's honestly really hard to tell how many people were involved in this thing, because the engineers at the technicians at the mission control center, where they're at their monitors and whatnot. You've seen those videos of them at the controls. Yeah, these individuals, right, they simply read what's on their computer screens and don't need to know or care where the data comes from. And so those people, in fact, that's how during the simulations, what they would do, they'd have simulated data relayed to them over the landlines, and they would make decisions based on the information. The simulations were so realistic that no controller could tell the difference between the training and the real mission. So I believe that those technicians at Houston were most likely duped by simulated data. And they just simply receive their information from the NASA manned spaceflight network, which are these radio tracking stations. NASA has a number of employers and contractors working at these different facilities. They're all either NASA owned or NASA controlled, right? It's not outside the realm of possibility that these guys at the tracking station simply relayed pre-recorded videos and they're on the moon and stuff, and just simply said, "Hey, this came from the moon." No one at Houston would be the wiser. But then again, there's also the possibility that the MISFN operators themselves could have been duped by this too, because prior to the Apollo missions, the Soviets, they had the Zonda 5 spacecraft.
Mm-hmm.
The Zond 5 was this stripped down Soyuz craft which flung around the far side of the moon and back again, and when it was in and was approaching the moon, the people at NASA and Jodrell Bank, they all received the voices of Pavel Popovich and Stavastinov, which are the voices of two cosmonauts. Right, initially everyone thought that, oh my God, the Soviets, they've beaten us around the moon, but it turned out that those voices were actually relayed to the spacecraft from some bunker in Moscow. Could NASA have done the same thing? You know, just simply sent an unmanned spacecraft and relay the voices, you know, from I don't know, maybe someplace on Earth or someplace from low Earth orbit. You know, it's possible. You know, it's really hard to tell if the I'm convinced that the technicians at Houston were duped. Whether or not the MISFIN operators were part of the conspiracy, or were they duped by relayed signals, you know, from some unmanned craft? You know, it's really hard to tell along those lines.
Right.
But I'm convinced that the administrator of NASA would have known this. You know, the people at the most higher up levels would have been in on the conspiracy. In fact, what's his name, James Webb, the administrator of NASA, right? He actually resigned in I think it was October or September. Basically, he resigned before the first manned moon flight.
That's interesting.
It makes you wonder. Perhaps he didn't want to go along with the conspiracy.
Right. Now what about the necessity for an expert who could create fake photography? Would that be a part of the Apollo simulation project?
It's funny you should mention that. They actually finding all these ways of simulating things. They actually had various different facilities and procedures to simulate lunar gravity, to simulate the landings and stuff. They had all these different simulators. Like they'd build accurate models of the moon. They'd build cranes at the Langley Research Center to, you know, train astronauts for lunar gravity, which would simulate them. They'd suspend them by wires, you know, and that would relieve them of their weight. And they could have easily incorporated this into the actual film sets. I believe that the film sets were probably in Area 51. You know, they out in Area 51 in the Nevada Desert. If you look at satellite pictures from that of that area, they have locations that look very similar to the moon. You know, all these barren cratered landscapes. In fact, they also did in Arizona. They even deliberately set off bombs out in the Arizona desert to accurately recreate the Sea of Tranquility. There was a documentary on that. It was called The Planets, episode 4 of which they actually had a clip in which they showed them doing that. It came out in 1999, that documentary. And it is believed by some that NASA could have actually hired Stanley Kubrick, the director and producer of 2001: A Space Odyssey, to actually film this. And there was a mockumentary that was released a few years ago as an April Fool's joke about how the Nixon administration hired Kubrick to film this and stuff. Of course, the film was a mockumentary, but it had some elements of truth in there. You know, what they did was they interviewed people who had worked with Kubrick. They'd interviewed the various Nixon administration officials, you know, and stuff. But of course, they were talking about something else, and they just intercut various fictional characters to make it look like they were talking about something else. When they were probably talking about Vietnam or Watergate or whatever, and they made it look like they were talking about Apollo. But there were some elements of truth in that. The one thing is that Kubrick and various other members of Hollywood were actually invited down to Cape Canaveral to make it appear more photogenic for the Apollo 11 launch. You know, they would put some spotlights here, set up the camera in this position, you know, and yeah, make it all look spectacular. That's excellent. Right. And in return, NASA, they actually let Kubrick borrow one of their cameras, you know, for low lighting conditions, so they could actually film the scenes in Barry Lyndon, which was a film completely shot with candlelight. You know, there was no studio light. Everything was candlelight. So he needed a certain camera to correctly film this.
And NASA had that particular camera.
Yes, and they let him use it in return for his contribution to his work on the Apollo 11 thing. So it is possible that he could have been involved, in filming the actual moonwalk scenes. How they filmed the moonwalk scenes, like what I believe they did is that they suspended the astronauts via wires, right? Just filmed them walking around on the wires, and then they played that footage down to they slowed it down, sorry, to 67% normal speed. So it looked like they've been slow, slowly walking around on the moon in the lunar gravity. And the MythBusters, they actually tried to debunk this on their special. They released a moon hoax special a few years ago, but the whole experiment was built on botched experiments because, like, they found one way or another, they found one ways to screw it up with the lunar gravity simulation thing. What they did is they simply filmed Savage in his suit, in his spacesuit, running around. First of all, they filmed him running around unsuspended, and then they slowed that footage down, and then they filmed him on jumping up and down on the wires, but they didn't slow it down. They shot the slow motion and the wires separately. All right, and but if you, the thing is, if you actually take the footage of him on the wire, slow it down to 67% speed, and then play it alongside the original Apollo archives, we get a near perfect synchronization. I actually approached Savage at TAM8, the amazing meeting in Las Vegas back in 2010, and he had a Q&A session. He was giving a speech, after which there was a Q&A session. He said, if there is anything that I've screwed up on the show that you guys want to talk about, just raise your hand. Like, don't tempt me, don't tempt me, don't tempt me. Ooh, ooh, ooh. I raise my hand, I get picked, and I say, the whole program was built on botched experiments because of this, this, and this. And then he's like, I hadn't thought of that. What we do isn't science. We're an entertainment show.
Wow.
An entertainment show. We're not. It's entertainment, not science. Jesus. And you think of all the times they gloated about how it was busted, and yet, I could tell you times when I've met people socially, telling them about the how it was a fake, and then someone would say, "Oh, what about this MythBusters episode? Have you seen that before?" And imagine how these people would respond to learn that from the horse's mouth. It's just entertainment. It's just an entertainment show. It's not science.
Right. Amazing. So, who made all of the money via the contracts that NASA passed out to make all of these vehicles and the rocket and, all the stuff that they needed to do this so-called flight?
There was a whole number of different contractors that they had. They had obviously they had the Rocketdyne Group, which was the company that built the engines on the Saturn V. They had Grumman, who was building the lunar module, and they had North American Aviation, who was building the Apollo Command Module, the mothership. See, there's two different spacecrafts. One is the mothership, the CSM, and one is the lunar module, which is what they supposedly used to land on the moon. These were all built by many different contractors, and there was a lot of cash made. I don't recall the numbers offhand right now, but in total it was $135 billion in 21st century currency.
Whoa. And getting back to Hollywood and Stanley Kubrick, Hollywood and Washington have basically been in cahoots for a long time because Hollywood made a lot of pro-war movies and all that kind of thing in order to set the public up to go to war. Even in World War I, they had all of these war movies and movies where it showed that the Germans were committing atrocities and it's all to just to get the public to cooperate and to do what the government wants. And so it doesn't surprise me a bit to think that maybe Kubrick had something to do with this Apollo flight.
Yeah, they had been the cube the whole Hollywood has been involved in a lot of propaganda movies throughout the years. You see them even today. You see the media, like how often do you see any reports of all the horrors that were actually going on in Iraq and Afghanistan? All you'd see is you just see the one side of things. They'd never show you what's happening in those prisons and whatnot. It was crazy. And yeah, and as it, but going back to the whole Apollo thing, yes, they have been releasing a whole number of they have they the film industry and NASA have been in cahoots with one another for quite some time. In fact, I believe it was Initially, von Braun, he actually got into cahoots with Walt Disney to actually advertise, to actually sell his space program to the world, to get it to, you know, to get public interested. I
Oh.
believe they did that in the 50s. Of course, Disney died before the moon missions and stuff, but they had Kubrick as well. And you know, they'd use Hollywood to advertise their program and get people suck it in, if you will.
No, so it was his program, Von Braun's program.
Von Braun, he actually got in touch with Walt Disney to get people interested in the space program. This was back in the 50s. I forget the exact year, but he had wrote a number of books about space travel at the time. But he would also, you know, talk about the things that would happen as well, like the huge crater that would be under the thing, the rocket requirements, and everything else. And eventually, evidently, you know, the Apollo simulation project was assembled in 1961, and it was around those times. You know, this is after, obviously, they've got all this radiation information available. They decided, okay, we're going to have to simulate this. Let's see how we can go about simulating it. That was in 1961 when the Apollo simulation project was first assembled.
Okay. Now, why would the government, what was the motivation, or what do you think the motivation was for the US government to lie to the people and pretend that they did something that they actually didn't?
Well, back to then, they were in a propaganda war with the Soviets. You know, both sides were basically shouting off their big mouth, saying, "Oh, look what we can do," and they needed they. Plus, there was a lot of political, what's the word I'm looking for? Basically, things were looking pretty bad. What with Vietnam and everything else that was going on as well, so it would also help as a diversionary tactic. So in the it had a number of purposes in the end. In the long run, you know, it would make the Americans look technologically superior to the Russians, and it would also help draw public attention away from the more serious matters at hand.
Okay, make us feel victorious about something.
Yes. And it's kind of ironic when you look in the long run, right? The last Apollo mission to the moon was 1972, right? No one's been back to the moon then, and the Soviets, you know, the Russians, they never sent anyone to the moon, right? But in the long run, they've made a whole number of other achievements. They've currently the Russian Soyuz is the only way Americans can get back to the space station. So yeah, and plus there was a number of other things too, like the Russian shuttle was considered technologically superior to the American shuttle. You know, it didn't have any of that falling foam damage risk or any of the it had ejection seats for everyone on board. You know, that was a vast leap over what the Americans had designed. You know, the space shuttle was a piece of junk. You know, it's done some great things, but it's meant to, in the long run, it was a risk. It was a risk for a piece of junk, but the Russians, they only launched their shuttle once, and they said they didn't have any real need for it because they only needed it as a military thing, you know, to carry bombs into space. But their shuttle, the Americans, they would normally carry their payloads into space, you know, to assemble space stations, whatnot. The Russians, they didn't do that. They would just simply launch them into space with a guidance system aboard to basically bring them, control them, to have them dock in Earth orbit and assemble the ships by themselves. The Americans didn't do it that way, and that was that the way the Russians had planned on doing things was a huge leap over the Americans. You know, think about all these great things that the Russians have done in space, and yet they never sent anyone to the moon.
Now, did the United States, do you think, want to give the impression that that we were going to own space, that we were going to have dominance, you know, like in the Space Force program?
Yeah, they were trying to create that impression for sure throughout the Cold War, and because like the it's whoever controlled space pretty much controls the world. That was the party line, and they had many other plans for the scientific community, I should say, had many plans for even further space travel. Like, there was plans for bases on the moon, there was plans for visits to Mars, flybys around Venus, and you know, in fact, they even and it was even believed that the space shuttle would actually replace the intercontinental flights, international flights. It would believe that passengers would simply board the space shuttle and it would launch into space and touch back down in some far off place, like it'd get you from Sydney to London in like 20 minutes or 30 minutes. I forget the exact numbers right now, but of course those are some great ideas, but they had nothing to do with the military objective, which was basically, being first to the moon. And so after the Apollo 13 mission, right, there were the near fatal disaster, right? The Apollo mission was conveniently cancelled, and all the elaborate plans were pretty much flushed down the toilet.
Right. Yeah, this is very interesting, and it's I have to laugh every time I hear some politicians say something about the moon landing. I just think this is so funny. I mean, here it is, 50 years later, and they're still trying to get people to believe that this happened. How many people do you think really believe that this happened? Do you think there are people that actually believe this?
It's hard to tell, honestly, because like some people probably might believe this stuff because maybe they it was something they grew up with and it made them feel happy, watching this sort of thing. So to take it away, it's like telling a kid that Santa Claus doesn't exist, so some people might just try to deny that it's a hoax. They just want to continue, believing it. Others are indeed probably lying about it, and they know that they're lying about it. Like Phil Plait and Jay Windley, and probably the MythBusters. I'm convinced that they do not believe what they tell their audiences. Phil Plait in particular,
Well,
and.
even when you just watch the video from that time, from the so-called moon landing, I mean, it's so obvious that it's fake. I mean, to me, it just looks so fake. And why haven't they repeated this great big feat?
Yes, that's true. Like if it was for real, you'd expect we'd probably be living on Mars now. We'd
Right.
have all these we'd have a permanent presence in space, and the every time the American president is in danger in the opinion polls, they always seem to propose an ambitious plan for space travel, to help get them more votes. And as soon as they got what they wanted, it's cancelled either by them or the other guy that follows them.
Right.
Like with George Bush Senior, I believe in the 1980s he proposed a return to the moon by 2010. Or was it 1999? Yeah,
Some,
probably.
yeah, some.
Whichever it was, he proposed it and never happened. Then Bush Jr. comes along. He proposes we'll have men on the moon and then Mars. First we'll be on the moon by 2020. Right? Then Obama comes along and that gets cancelled. Right? Everyone starts hating on him, and then he says, "Okay, we're going to skip the moon and head off to Mars."
Thought that was so funny.
Yeah.
And people, I guess people forget what the politicians promise, or they're so used to the politicians lying that they just don't take them serious anymore. But it's so preposterous that they would even be talking about this.
Yeah, the only people who seem to be able to the only person who, people who seem to have any commitment to this is the private firm now. There's the company SpaceX who are proposing sending people to Mars sometime. I believe Elon Musk. He this is a private firm. In fact, just a few months ago, their Dragon spacecraft actually carried the first resupplies. Privately carried resupplies to the space station. That was a first for the private industry. And but Elon Musk says his plans are to actually send men to the moon in the near future. He hasn't unveiled the plans yet, but I had some theories on how he might be planning on doing it, and I believe they might be able to do it eventually. But we have to wait to see what they're proposing. What I believe is what they might be planning on doing is actually building. They've got a large rocket planned, the Falcon 20, which can carry 140 metric tons into Earth orbit. Right, what I theorize is that that would certainly carry the shelter. Is the shelter you need, right? You need 2 meters of water, so a small capsule surrounded by 2 meters of water that would have a mass of 109 tons. That could easily lift the thing, right? Then there's also the living quarters, where the astronauts would stay. That would probably be about 16 tons. And then you've got the Dragon spacecraft, which weighs 6 tons. So that entire stack would weigh 131 tons. So his Falcon 20 could easily lift that into Earth orbit, and we'd probably need another rocket to carry the, all the fuel required to actually, send the craft there to Mars, because, that's all you can send into Earth orbit. You need more power to send it to the Moon or Mars or whatnot. So I think that SpaceX might be able to do, will probably be able to do that. I'm pretty confident that that might be their strategy. I produced a video about that recently. It's called SpaceX Man on Mars for $500,000.
Oh, all
That's what
righty.
he's proposing. But we'll have to wait later this year until the official unveiling.
Right.
So in the long run, it seems the only I think that that SpaceX, if this is their strategy, this is just my educated guesses on what's available, right? But if this is their strategy, then I think SpaceX will have solved the radiation obstacle, and maybe we will be able to get to Mars someday. We don't know. But
Right.
the thing is, SpaceX, they don't have any plans for moon missions, and they said, oh, we'll fly anyone to the moon if they want to go to the moon, no problem. And it's the thing is, just in fact, another private company, Astrobotic Technologies, they are actually building a unmanned lunar rover, which they had planned on sending to the Apollo 11 landing site to actually land on the moon, and drive, close to the lunar module, the flag, take videos and send them back to the Earth, and SpaceX were is supposed to send the rocket to the moon, right? That was all planned to happen next year, right? But then just a few months ago, I believe it was in October last year, NASA announced that the Apollo landing sites would be declared no-fly zones to protect the rocket exhaust, to protect the spacecraft, the artifacts, and everything else from rocket exhaust and dust from future missions.
Right.
And as soon as that was announced, right, they Astrobotic Technologies and SpaceX, they changed their destination. They changed it to the lunar North Pole.
That's safe, right?
Yeah, because there's no manned landings there, so they're just going to have to explore there now. It's I think a lot of people who have commented on this have said it best. Since when does NASA own the moon?
Right. And the big question for me was always, okay, they needed all this energy, all this power to lift off of the Earth. How did they happen? What did they use to lift off of the moon to come back? They didn't have a landing. They didn't have a have a setting to lift off of, right?
I'm not sure I understand what your question is, but the what they say is that they had the lunar module would have an ascent stage and a descent stage, one for landing on the moon and the other for making the ascent back up to the up into lunar
Oh,
orbit.
okay.
That's what they claim they've done. But the whole fact of the matter is that they didn't have the shielding. If you added the 2 meters of water around the spacecraft, that would have made it way too heavy for the Saturn V to lift. That would have made it too heavy for the Saturn V to lift, and so they wouldn't have been able to do it. And in fact, a few years ago, I believe one of the shuttle astronauts, James Van Hoften, he and his committee wrote a report on the radiation that will be encountered on future missions to the Moon and Mars, and he actually proposed, parking the pressurized rover. They were planning on building a pressurized rover to the moon on future flights. He proposed actually parking it inside a lunar lava tube, a cave, to protect the astronauts from the radiation. And he says it's going to be such a hazard that astronauts might be forced to pretty much cancel EVAs or limit the amount of time that they can spend walking on the moon. Well, if it's going to be such a hazard on the future missions, then how did they do it in the first place?
Exactly. these questions, these things are just so preposterous. Really. And yet people still believe this, and yet they don't ask these questions. They don't talk about these things that you're talking about. And speaking of which, what is your educational background? And how did you get interested in this? And what made you ask the first question about it? What made you skeptical?
Well, the first part of your question, I've done my degrees in filmmaking. I've done a film and TV course, and I'm currently doing my BSc in astrophysics. And the second part of your sort of second part of your question, I as a kid I was always very interested in space travel. I had always watched the documentaries, the educational programs. As a kid, everyone else was watching cartoons. I was watching those educational documentaries. I was a real big space fan, and I wanted to be the first man on Mars someday. Then later, during my teenage years, I hear this the moon hoax theory, and I think, oh, this is interesting. And so I read it. I decided to just to check it out, for curiosity's sake. And I look up various websites, various documentaries, various books, from both sides of the matter. And after studying both sides of the argument, I came to the conclusion that the moon missions were fake, and largely the members of the pro-NASA side are outright lying to their audiences, because the what they put out is pretty much it's like they're not trying to convince people who doubt the moon landings. It seems more like they're trying to convince people who do not have ready access to the to all the information available, and that allows them to manipulate their reader's mind. If you don't give them all the information, how are you supposed to come put two and two together? Like, for example, one of the sites says that the minor solar flares can't hurt you, and yet in 1963 there was a book called Astronautical Engineering and Science, written by various guys at the Marshall Space Flight Center, and it said that the minor solar flares can deliver as much as 25 rems per hour, depending on how much water you're using as shielding. We use rems to measure how much radiation a person is getting. 500 rem is the death dose for humans. And so, I guess I finally got, fed up of seeing all these propaganda sites, constantly duping people. It would be impossible to have a conversation with someone without someone else, pointing it, you in the direction of these pro-NASA TV shows or websites or whatnot. And so I finally decided to have my to have my say in it, have my basically put out my response to what these guys have to say. So I started writing up this long, long essay. It was originally supposed to be for download off the Bill Kaysing tribute website, but I spent about a year and a half writing it. I interviewed Ralph Renay. He wrote NASA Moon America, and eventually it's finished, but the essay is now the size of a phone book.
Oh,
And so,
my.
yeah, I know. And then I'm reading through it, and they're like, okay, this is pretty good, but there was certain back then I had limited tolerance for the lies that were on the internet, and so there were certain less than polite things I had to say about these individuals, and so I thought, maybe that should be cut, because I
Right.
had developed tolerance then, and so. And so I decided, well, why didn't I start, producing documentaries on this? Why didn't I release, okay, this one video will discuss that, one video will discuss this, and just release what you had to say that way. And that's pretty much how the Moonfaker series came about. I've been doing that since 2006, and I've produced well over 100, probably well over 200 documentaries now. You have to chop them up into little pieces to get them to fit onto YouTube and stuff. But I've honestly lost count of how many documentaries I've put together.
Right. Now, do you have what is your YouTube channel?
White Jarrah.
Okay.
Yes, it's basically my surname first, and my first name after that. Originally,
Right.
the account was Jera White, but after I released a video called "Flagging the Gems," which was my video proving that the Apollo 10 telecasts were faked, that these were pre-filmed and edited together, right? Mark Gray of Spacecraft Films, he files DMCA copyright infringement takedowns on the videos and gets the old account suspended. Now he claimed.
Oh.
He claimed I violated his copyright. Well, it's public domain footage. You've got no claim to it.
Right.
It's a felony to falsely claim copyright.
Sure.
And so he was abusing the DMCA to try and silence the my expose.
Right.
Because not only did I show that the Apollo 10 telecasts were faked, I also showed that certain pieces of existing footage were missing from his so-called complete DVD sets.
Now, speaking of silencing, What do you think happened to Grissom, White, and Chafee? Were they silenced? Were they asking too many questions? Were they opposing what they were asked to do? Was it an accident? Was it deliberate? What do you think?
I don't think it was an accident, because, like, if you know, an accident is when you do something without prior knowledge of the consequences, right? It was pretty clear that NASA knew from the start that this was going to be a death trap. You know, they had done three tests, NASA, with pure oxygen. Each test turned into a disaster. In fact, one of the tests, a fellow was changing a light bulb, and a spark happened. His clothing is his sleeve caught on fire, right? And some guy comes running over with an asbestos blanket. You know, that normally he uses asbestos as fireproofing. You know, use it as a fire safety blanket. He wraps his arm around in it to try to cover up the flames. And then what happens? The blanket itself goes up in fire too.
Wow.
And yeah, in another test, this was in 1965, I think it was. Two of the occupants died, right? So they had about four or five different tests. I forget how many of the tests it was, but in one of them, two of the people died, right? So this was all documented by NASA. It illustrated, they even did a report on it that illustrated, that said, these fires illustrate in concrete fashions the potential dangers of pure oxygen, right? And yet they put Grissom, White, and Chafee inside a capsule at 20 psi pure oxygen. You know, at 20 psi pure oxygen, even stainless steel will burn.
Wow.
Yes. So the hatch they put on the thing, it was completely useless, because like it could only be opened from the outside, and even then it needed 90 seconds to get open. Right, in an emergency, it was practically unusable. Right, and it was decided, okay, we'll change it to a more safety hatch, to a much more safe hatch, and one that can be opened in 20 seconds. Right, but here's the thing: the Apollo 1 plugs out test was supposed to be the last time this old hatch was going to be used, but it was also the first time. You know, if they have a new hatch, you know, going to be installed in this thing, why not just simply postpone the test until you've got the newer, safer one installed on the thing?
Of course.
And As for Grissom himself, right, he was actually complaining about the Apollo 1, about the Apollo program in general. He believed that the Americans only had a 1 in 3 chance of actually making it to the moon, and he was so angry about the spacecraft, he actually hung a lemon on it. He took a lemon off his tree and hung it on the spacecraft.
Signal to people, huh?
Yes, pretty much. And his son, Scott Grissom, he, in 1999, he was actually given access to his father's spacecraft. And whilst he was actually, you know, allowed to go into the warehouse where it's kept and, you know, have a look at all the damage and whatnot. And he discovered that a metal plate had been shoved behind the dashboard to deliberately trigger a spark when the certain button was pressed.
Wow.
Yes. Yeah, there was an article about that in Star magazine. It's called My Astronaut Dad Was Murdered.
Wow. Well, you won't be hearing that on the nightly news.
Probably not. Yeah. He was constantly saying that the whole program was a lemon. He thought we only have a 1 in 3 chance of making this thing to the moon, right? And on the day of the fire, right, they were having problems with the communications. He says, "How are we supposed to get to the moon if we can't even talk between two or three buildings?"
Right, right, of course.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so Grissom was most likely murdered, and so was Barron. You know, he had additional information, you know, to confirm what Grissom had been saying, that this thing was in jeopardy. This program is not going to work. And his 500 page report actually disappeared after he was found dead by the railroad crossing.
Right. Okay, I forgot to ask about that. So he was found dead by the railroad crossing from being hit by a train.
Yes, his car had been pushed onto the rails.
You know, okay, so was he dead before they pushed the car into the rails, I wonder?
I don't know. It was claimed that he had committed suicide.
Oh,
he had committed suicide. I know. That's my reaction to it as well. And so people, you know, people on the inside, you know, you start speaking up too loudly, you get knocked off. If you're on the outside and you start speaking up too loudly, right, you just get ridiculed.
Right.
So that's the way it works with this system.
So did they do a autopsy on this guy?
No, his body was never autopsied, and he was promptly cremated. He was
How
promptly
handy.
cremated. His wife and stepdaughter were also killed in that car. He actually had two stepdaughters. One survived, but she was only an infant at the time and stuff, so she doesn't remember the events of that thing. So
Oh,
unfortunately.
yep, this one child.
Hang on a second, there's some calling here.
Oh.
Are you trying to call me just a second?
No.
Strange. Strange, I just heard some ringing on the phone here.
Huh.
Okay. Well, as I was saying, he had his wife and two stepdaughters were in the car too. One of the stepdaughters died, his wife also died, and the surviving stepdaughter, she was only an infant at the time. And so obviously, she couldn't, she probably, she wouldn't have been able to remember what would have happened that day. And so, but here's the thing: the railroad crossing was actually about 30 or so kilometers away from Barron's house. In fact, it was even over water. In fact, it was even over water, right? If he was trying to commit suicide, why not just simply drive the car off the bridge?
Right.
It doesn't make any sense that he would drive 2 hours away from his house just to commit suicide at a railroad crossing, especially if you're gonna have to cross the water to just to get there.
Right.
So
Very, very suspicious.
yeah. And
Okay. Well, this has been very, very interesting. I'm hearing my echo again.
oh, hang on a second. How's this? Does this work better?
I think that's better. Oh no, I
Okay.
still hear it. I still
Oh
hear
dear.
it.
Oh
Well,
dear.
this has been very interesting. I hope that we can do this again. And I hope that people will go to your YouTube channel,
Yeah.
and that's youtube.com/whitejarrah, correct?
That's correct.
And that's JARRAH.
That's correct. That's correct. I'd also like to say that if there's any viewers, any sorry, any listeners in Italy, I will be appearing at the Lake Solitude restaurant in Brescia to give a couple lectures. I'll be giving a lecture on Ralph René's moon hoax research and also my own research. That's at the International Conference of the Lunar Singularity. I'll be appearing there, and so will Wendy Kasing, who is the daughter of Bill Kasing.
Oh, how exciting! How
Yeah.
wonderful!
Yes, that'll be held on July 14th.
All righty. Well, I hope
I'm very excited.
that people will attend, and I hope that you enjoy going to Italy.
Yep, I'm looking forward to it. It's by the judging by the pictures, it certainly is a beautiful country.
Oh yes. I've never been there, but they do. I've seen a lot of pictures.
I'll send you a postcard.
Oh, okay. That might be the closest I'll ever get to Italy. Well, thank you so much, Jerry. I really appreciate you being on the program.
No worries. The pleasure is all mine.
Okay, and we'll do this again. Thank you so much.
Right, bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay.